Let's get started. You are
Sure.
a science fiction author. You write on Boing Boing. How did you came into the internet?
Well, I think like a lot of people, I started with BBSs. Actually, my first telecommunications was pre-BBS. My dad was a computer scientist in the 60s and 70s. And in the mid-70s, he went back to school to become a teacher. And he brought home from the university a VAX terminal with an acoustic coupler. And it was just a teletype terminal. There was no screen. And I just loved hacking on that thing. And, you know, must have used up like hundreds of rolls of paper in 1977 when I was six. And then in 79, he was the head of computer science at a local high school. And Apple gave all the heads of computer science free Apple II pluses for the summer to convince them, because he was actually, I think the way that they did it was his students would create punch card stacks that they would go and batch on a machine off premises, and then he'd bring them back the output. So it was a very hard way to learn computer science. So even having two Apple II pluses in the lab would have been so much far superior to this thing. So we got the 2 plus in 79 that summer and completely hooked on it. And sometime in the following year, we bought our Hayes 300 baud modem. And the trick was all of our slots were full. There was like a paddle controller and a 64K and 80 columns and so on. And so you'd have to choose what you were going to take out to put. So like I'd take out the floppy, you know, one of the floppy controllers and the paddle controller or whatever and slot in the modem and reboot. And dial BBSs. And my dad had a friend who brought over 100 feet of printout of BBS numbers. And I would just dial them until I found one that was live. And then I eventually got my own machine and my own phone line for this, for BBSing. But it was a problem because they were always busied out. And I was still using the modem, and the modem didn't have a touch tone mode. But I had a touch tone handset. So I would pick up the phone and I'd dial the number with touch tone. And when I got a busy signal, I'd hang it up and redial really quick. And as soon as I heard a carrier, I'd type in ATH and hit return, or AT and hit return, and then slam down the phone. And the modem would pick up the carrier, and I'd be in. And then I used some of the commercial online services, and then I got a Unix shell account at the University of Toronto when I was in high school. It was the first people to offer shells, and it was 50 cents an hour. It was really expensive for shell access. Slow, too, 9600 baud, I think. And then I had a GUI account, which I mostly used to fool around with Gopher. I started programming CD-ROMs commercially for a company in New York called Voyager. And as the CD-ROM industry was falling apart, I started to try to sell commercial Gopher services to advertising agencies. And in the middle of my first client who paid me to make commercial Gopher sites for them, I started playing around with NCSA Mosaic and the web, and converted them from being a customer for a Gopher site to a customer for a website, and went from there to running my own small business as a consultant. And then I became the chief information officer of a marketing and tech services company. And then I founded a peer-to-peer software company, open source peer-to-peer software company that we sold in 2003. And before that, I left there to come work for EFF. So that's kind of my history as a geek.
Mm. When did you started writing for Boing Boing?
I think this is my fifth anniversary this January.
Well, did you have been there from the start?
Or? No. So in the start, Boing Boing was a print magazine. And, you know, like a lot of print magazines in the U.S., small press magazines, although it did well enough to support itself commercially, when a key distributor failed, it took the magazine with it. They weren't secured creditors of the distributor, which meant that the bank came in and seized all the inventory, which was the magazine they'd paid to have printed, along with lots of other small press magazines, and all the accounts, which included the money that had been paid out for the magazines that they'd sold. And so Boing Boing, the magazine, and their distributor had all their money and all their copies of the magazine, and it was owned by a bank now, and they weren't going to turn it over to them. And so they failed. They folded. And the founders, Mark and his wife Carla and Gareth Branwen, all went off to do other things. Mark became a managing editor at Wired, and I think, and then branched out into other magazines. He was working on the mastheads of, I think, the Industry Standard and the Red Herring, all these technology business things, where they weren't as quirky as Boing Boing had been, although they were very techy. And I think when Blogger came out, he wanted to test the service, and he thought, oh, maybe I'll try bringing Boing Boing back as a blog. And he did it for like a year, and it was had a small but devoted readership. He had a news scoop. He found out what Dean Kamen had invented when the Segway was first announced, and no one knew what the Segway was. All they knew was that Dean Kamen was about to ship something. No one knew what it was, and he looked up the patent drawing and then blogged it, and CNN covered it that night and showed Boing Boing, and he got a spike of like 7,000 readers, up from like 40 readers the day before. And he wrote to me, because we knew each other, and he said, you know, I'm going away on holiday, but I think these people will probably come back. It would be nice if someone were blogging tomorrow and the day after and the day after. Do you want a guest blog for me? And so I took over as a guest, and then when he came back, he said, oh, you did a great job, why don't you stay on? And we brought on Shenny, and we brought on David, and now we've got a team.
Yeah, and it's the biggest web blog in the world.
By some metrics. I don't know, biggest is a funny... identifier, because it's not clear what that means. But I think we have the largest readership, and I know that we have the most number of inbound links according to Technorati. We're certainly among the largest weblogs in the world. Yeah.
And what's the concept behind Boing Boing?
It's the things that four people who are eclectic and technical in their outlook are interested in today.
Okay. Let's come to the next.
Sure.
Part. You are the European speaker of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Yeah,
how did you came into the EFF?
So I founded a peer-to-peer software company, an open-source peer-to-peer software company called OpenCola, with two other founders. And we raised a bunch of money. It was a time when it was good to raise money for peer-to-peer open-source businesses. We raised $14 million. And we were getting ready to ship our product. And at that time, Napster became the subject of a bunch of lawsuits. Most importantly, they became the subject of a lawsuit in which their investors and the limited partner in their investors were named as parties to the suit. So the people who gave them the money and the people who gave those people the money, insurance companies and so on. And I think every venture capitalist in America suddenly went, oh my God, we can't possibly do this, and freaked out. And they really started to crack down on us. And they basically prevented us from shipping. They became really, really scared of what was going to happen to them. And we had to keep going back to them and presenting to them why we thought what we were doing was going to be legal or defensible or what have you. And EFF was really helpful. We'd had some connection with EFF because a lot of our programmers were in the Cult of the Dead Cow. And so EFF had a long-standing relationship with CDC, and they introduced us to them. When EFF needed some office space in San Francisco, we had some extra office space. They moved in with us for a while, and we were just very friendly. And I basically said to them at one point, like, I want to work with you guys. And they weren't sure if they could. And then they got a donation that would have paid my salary, and they called me up and said, if you want a job, we'll give you a job. So I quit working for the company I'd founded, because it seemed to me that this was the more important thing to do, that making it legal for people to found that kind of company was more important than any one company was going to be. And so that's what I did. I jumped ship for EFF, stayed in San Francisco for 2 more years, working for EFF on killing the broadcast flag in America. And then I jumped to being the European coordinator, mostly to work on the European broadcast flag.
So can you describe what the broadcast flag is and what the dangers are?
There's a lot of ways to kind of describe what the broadcast flag is. A lot of people say, oh, the broadcast flag is a flag, and when it's in a broadcast stream and when it's there, you have to look for it and respond to it by restricting copying in some ways. And that's kind of true as it goes. But the most important thing about a broadcast flag is that it's a regulation that says that people who build devices that receive digital television or that sit downstream from a digital television receiver, like a PC, have to build it with only those features that are approved by the entertainment industry, right? You can talk about which restrictions it has and which restrictions it doesn't have and so on, but the most important thing is that this is a law that says if you want to make a new device, you have to get permission from people whose business you might be disrupting with it. never really had that law. And it's a good thing because, generally speaking, we can imagine that people whose business is going to be disrupted by a new technology don't want to give permission for this to happen. So I think, a really dangerous regulation. One element of the regulation is that you can't build a digital television or a device that sits downstream of a digital television that's modifiable by its user, or readily modifiable. They call it tamper resistance. Because obviously, if you're going to restrict the feature set to those that are approved by the entertainment industry, you don't want to add in, you don't want the user to be able to add in features that the entertainment industry doesn't want them to have. Now, notice that this has nothing to do with what copyright says or doesn't say. This isn't about making sure that these devices respect copyright. This is about making sure that these devices don't disrupt entertainment industry's business models. They're disjoint, right? There's a little bit of overlap, but they're not the same thing. And you know, I'll talk later today at my talk about what copyright protects and what broadcast flags protect and how they're different. But this is a new way to operate. It's a law that says essentially that all the cars have to be shipped with their bonnets welded shut, right? Every PC has to be shipped with its hood welded shut. Every video card has to be made to resist end user modification. That's not good for technology. It's not good for innovation. It's not good for business. And I don't think it's good for entertainment either. You know, I think that ultimately what that does is it keeps the cost of providing and distributing entertainment products high, artificially high, which means that new entrants to the market are kept out. And that means that people who want to invent the next form of entertainment, the way that TV was a successor to movies, and movies were a successor to radio, and radio was a successor to phonograms, and phonograms were a successor to sheet music, and so on, that those people won't be able to develop their new technologies.
And what's the difference between the American broadcast flag and the European broadcast flag?
Well, so the European broadcast flag is actually a lot more restrictive than the American broadcast flag. The American broadcast flag, for starters, had no restrictions on the analog outputs, which is interesting because, of course, taking a digital copy from the analog outputs is easy. And the difference between a digital copy and a copy that's been made analog and then redigitized is pretty minimal. Right, and so if your objective is really to stop people from redistributing stuff over the internet or whatever, allowing analog outputs is a very strange move. Right, although in the U.S. they didn't want to do it because they thought that that would make it very unpopular with regulators. In Europe, there's a proposal to downsample or shut down the analog outputs. The European one contains a lot of granular restrictions that can be asserted by a broadcaster. The American ones only had restrict this to approved copy and output methods or don't. The European one, all outputs and recording methods are restricted. And then in addition to that, the behaviors of those recording and output methods can be further restricted by setting flags like how long can you store this, how many devices can you watch this on, how far away from the receiver can you watch this. And then a really interesting one is one that says you may only watch this on devices owned by a single family. So you have to ask, well, what's a family, right? You know, is a dorm a family? Is an old folks home a family? Is a co-op house a family? What's a household? And it's whatever the entertainment industry says it is. So copyright is, you know, copyright's a monopoly on who gets to copy, perform, or create new works from an original creative work. It's not a monopoly on what a family is, right? But what these people are trying to do is get a legal mandate that says that they get to define how big and under what circumstances you are allowed to call a group of people a family. It's really frightening.
On which level are they debating that topic? Is it in standardization organizations, or is it on the European political level?
It's in every area. So there's a standards body called the DVB that sets standards for European, Asian, Latin American, and Australian standards. And the German Public Service Broadcaster is a member. Germany's law prohibits scrambling digital television, or any television, for public service television, because, of course, it's supported by German taxpayers.
It's a way to drop them out of the internet, because the private companies don't want it.
Right. So what's happening is the public service broadcasters, I think, are saying, well, we won't scramble this, but I think what they do want is trusted computing for the receivers, because they want to be able to control what you do without scrambling, right? And the way to do that is to just say that anything that's a DTV receiver, anything that sits downstream of a DTV receiver, has to have a mandate on its characteristics. It's kind of like scrambling without the scrambling, right? You don't scramble the signal, but you make a law that says all technology must treat the signal as though it were scrambled, right? It's what they say in America is adhering to the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law, you know, not the intent of the law. At the European level, at the European policy level, at the Creative Economy Conference in London last week, which was the European Presidency event that the British government put on, across the board, there was talk of how the DVB restrictions should be part of European regulatory mandates. In every area, in every nation's government, there are people advocating to create national regulatory mandates before a directive comes in, because of course directives often follow on from national laws. You say, okay, well, some of our members already have this law, let's harmonize it across mm-hmm. the... So in every level of government, there's initiatives for this. And then at WIPO, which is the United Nations, there's a treaty underway called the Broadcasting Treaty that would mandate that where you had a restriction system like this, it would be illegal to circumvent it. So it's really, you're seeing it in America. You're seeing it in European national governments, in Brussels, in standards bodies, and at the United Nations. It's a very multilateral front that this battle is taking place on. And EFF has only recently started to really work on all these different fronts, because we realize that it's no good to defeat a law in the United States if it becomes a treaty at the United Nations. So now we're working on all these different fronts.
So yeah, it's the next... topic, WIPO.
Yeah.
There are two important treaties in the moment. One is the broadcast treaty, the other one is access to knowledge.
Yeah.
We had the broadcast treaty now. What is access to knowledge? What's the idea behind?
So I guess it was just a year ago, in September, so a year and a few months ago, a group of us who work at WIPO on reforming copyright, patent, and trademark law went and had a meeting with a bunch of people from the developing world, many of whom were the same people. There are a lot of activists from the developing world, to draft what we call the Geneva Declaration. And we wrote this document that basically said WIPO was admitted to the United Nations in the 70s on the grounds that it was going to become a humanitarian organization. And that as a humanitarian organization, it was going to foster laws that were coherent with the other humanitarian instruments like the International Declaration on the Rights of the Child, UN Charter of Human Rights, and so on. Things that would promote personal well-being and liberty and other humanitarian objectives. And WIPO's never really considered any kind of humanitarian objective in its treaty making. All it's ever done is considered ways to expand the scope of exclusive rights over information goods, no matter what impact that had on creativity or humanitarian goals. So we called on them to create a development agenda, an agenda that could be used as a lens to evaluate every new initiative that came out of WIPO to determine whether or not it was something that was good for development. The governments of Argentina, Brazil, and India, as well as some of the other developing nations, went to the plenary session in October of WIPO and said, we demand a development agenda. This was in the wake of a number of very exciting negotiations on international treaties, where delegations from the developing world had left the table because they refused to participate in these negotiations, as they perceived them as being negotiations that were unilateral, to basically force them to give up some of the freedoms that were helping them improve their national lot without any concomitant benefit. It was all threat. And the WIPO agreed to do this. So now there's a big fight over what it means that WIPO is going to create a development agenda. The U.S. and European and U.K. delegations have argued for ridiculous proposals. Like they said, maybe we should have the negotiations take place in the Permanent Committee on IP and Development, which is a committee that meets every 2 years, has no budget and no mandate. And in that way, we'll be able to somehow advance development at WIPO. Or maybe we should have a website where people from developing nations could hook up with people from, or governments from non-developing nations to talk about copyright. But no one said things like, let's have a treaty in which we guarantee that people who are engaged in providing access to the disabled have the same rights all over the world, right? So that's what we did. We wrote a treaty called the Access to Knowledge Treaty. It's had input from dozens of non-governmental organizations and governments from developing nations that says these are the harmonized sets of rights and freedoms that every country should give to people who are engaged in providing access to disabled people, archivists, and educators, which are key to promoting development. And you can read the document yourself. Just Google A2K. But it basically sets out a series of you've got an A2K Make It So shirt. Good man. it's meant to be contain the kind of thing that you can't plausibly disagree with if you believe, if you promote yourself as a humanitarian organization. If you're going to be a humanitarian organization, you should be providing harmonized rights for people who give access to educators and disabled people and so on.
And how is the mood at WIPO since non-governmental organizations built that alliance with developing countries?
Not very happy. You know, Gandhi said first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. And it's on that schedule we're pretty close to winning because they're sure fighting us. There was a meeting last year where the documents that we brought to hand out to the delegations were actually stolen and thrown in the toilets, in the rubbish bins in the toilets. That's been the kind of level of resistance we faced. There was a movement to shut non-governmental organizations, most non-governmental organizations, out of the negotiation over the development agenda. There's been any number of kind of procedural dirty tricks aimed at undermining participation from NGOs, and certainly we get the amount of kind of sliming and smearing we get from some of the rights holder groups has been amazing. So,
okay, next topic: Creative Commons.
Yeah,
you're also an advocate for Creative Commons.
I am.
Your latest book was released under the developing license.
The DevNet license,
yeah. So there's a big discussion worldwide about these non-free in the view of Richard Stallman license. Why did you choose that?
Well, I also chose I chose two non-free licenses that I think Richard might not like. One was that one, and then the other one is the non-commercial no derivatives license. I chose it because I believed that releasing this book under this license would create socially beneficial outcomes and would also help me sell more books. And I didn't think that a license that provided access to developing nations license that provided access to developed nations in the same terms as developing nations would give me the same benefit or create the same social outcomes. So I thought that if I let people in developing nations print and arrange their own editions, that on the one hand it would sell more copies of the book in the developed world, because I think a lot of people from developing nations become expats. You know, they're the kind of best and brightest of many developing nations, for good or ill, end up living in the developed world, and they often continue with the reading habits that they developed at home. So I thought it would be to my advantage for my work to be widely disseminated in developing nations. I also thought that from a developing nation printer's perspective, a publisher's perspective, having a pool of works that you can freely print and distribute in your national context would actually help you build your business. However, I did think that if I let people print commercial editions in the U.S., apart from my publisher, that it would cost me my deal with my publisher. My publisher would not publish a book if other publishers were allowed to produce their own commercial editions. And that it would likewise, if I did that and said to people, and you don't have to compensate me for your commercial editions sold in the developed world, that I wouldn't get any income from the books. And the books are a critical piece of my income. So it was purely selfish and greedy. You know, what I did was I performed a calculus where I said, what is the most I can let go of this without hurting my ability to earn a living? Not hurting my ability to write, because most writers don't earn a living from writing. I don't come close to earning a living from writing, but it's enough of my living that it's pretty important to me. But of course I'd go on writing even if I wasn't making any money from it. I mean, I wrote for a decade before I made my first cent from writing, so it's not like it's, you know, I don't think that there's a tight coupling there. But I want to earn as much money as I can from writing, and I think that giving stuff away helps me do that. But I think that, in particular, giving away electronic books while selling paper books to people in developed nations is the best way of accomplishing that. Now, I think that that might change in 10 years. And if it does, I think that I'll change what I'm doing too, because I feel that the one thing we know about the 21st century is whatever it is you're doing to earn your living today probably won't exist in 10 years, and you better be ready to change it to something else then.
Okay. And when we see the situation in Europe comparing to the United States, in the United States there are lots of foundations and NGOs working on the fields of digital rights, free software, open content. In Europe it seems like there are 20, 30 people having absolutely no donations from the donation culture in the United States. How do you see the difference?
I'm not sure. I can't really work that out. Although, you know, let's not give short shrift to the very, very, very good European activist groups, from CC to Bits of Freedom to EDRI to, you know, Quintessence and so on. I mean, innumerable organizations that do fantastic and important work. I know in the UK that the way the tax law is structured is if you're a nonprofit, you can't lobby to change laws. So that's a real problem. You can't offer people tax receipts in exchange for their donations that go into work that involves lobbying. So I think that that probably undermines this a lot. Europe has a strong culture of governmentally funded consumer rights groups, like WICH, and then on the Brussels level, BEUC, and so on. And I think those groups act as a proxy for a lot of this. I know BEUC has become very active in DRM fighting lately. They're very, very good. Their person in Brussels, a woman named Cornelia Couture, do you know her?
Yeah.
She's very good. Very, very, very sharp. So I think that that's that might be the one answer to the question. How do we encourage this? But I'm not really sure how we solve the problem of getting donation funded NGOs operating in a European context, because we need them. We really do. EFF does work in Europe. Donations that go to EFF can fund some of the work we do in Europe, and I encourage your readers to join EFF. I mean, I make a very large personal donation to EFF every year out of my salary, because I believe really strongly in the work we do, and I'm a member, and I'm a really proud member, and not just an employee. And I think that no matter where you live in the world, there's an advantage to joining EFF, that it helps you to be an EFF member. But I also think people need to start and participate in and fund local organizations.
What can normal people do without funding now in organizations? What can a reader or a listener to that interview do to defend digital rights, to promote?
Well, you know, there are European organizations you can join right now, including EFF. You can join EFF. You can join EDRI. You can join ORG in the UK.
Or you can't join EDRI.
Hmm?
EDRI is not.
Well, okay, fair enough. You can support EDRI. You can get the EDRI grant, right? You can sign up. You can donate to FIPR. You can donate to CCC. You can donate to Bits of Freedom. You can donate to Quintessence. You can volunteer for all these organizations, right? Those are positive things you can do. If you're one thing that I encourage everyone to do, who's a geek, who cares about this stuff, is to find 5 non-geek friends and explain to them why this is important. I think the most important way that we find out about things and become passionate about things is when our friends tell us about it. With books, I think the best way to sell a book is to have someone who loves it tell a friend why they love it. There's, you know, any amount of advertising, any amount of store placement and so on can't come close to that. The best way to raise support for an issue is to explain to a friend what it all means. You can use Creative Commons licenses on your work, but I think that in addition to using Creative Commons licenses on your work, you should go and explain to your friends why you're using Creative Commons licenses on your work, and not just geeks, average individuals too.
Okay, that was a nice last word.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you too.
Great.